So yeah, I want to continue exploring this sutra, this text from a phase of Buddhism called Mahayana Buddhism that has acquired real importance, particularly for certain schools of Buddhism, including Zen Buddhism. This text has been very, very influential in the Buddhist world, and I sometimes think it's actually just worth becoming familiar with texts that are traditionally very influential because they connect us with the Buddhist world. They connect us with this larger Buddhist world. And in a way, if you haven't heard of the White Lotus Sutra, in a way you haven't heard of one of the central kind of texts for a lot of Buddhists. One of the things that Sangharakshita is, I mean, he's a genius in so many ways, but one of his, I think, particular kind of geniuses is his ability to make accessible Dharma that perhaps, well, I would have found too abstruse, too way out and weird to be relevant or accessible. I would never have been able to just pick up the White Lotus Sutra and read it as a text. But what he has done is he's given commentaries on various texts, including the White Lotus Sutra, where he, in sort of seminar format, I imagine it was a bit like this, perhaps a bit smaller. It's before I was around. In seminar format, he would give lectures or start talking through the text, and then people would ask questions, etc. In fact, it wouldn't be even lectures that go through the text. He'd comment, people would ask questions, he'd comment more. They were all recorded, those seminars, and then transcribed, edited and transcribed. And the book on the White Lotus Sutra, his commentary on the White Lotus Sutra is this one. It's called The Drama of Cosmic Enlightenment. The Drama of Cosmic Enlightenment. And yeah, it's worth reading. It really is. It's got gems in, gems about the Dharma life, where really he uses the sutra as a sort of springboard, as a jumping off point to talk about Dharma that is, really relevant to all of us, while also honoring the truth of the sutra. So, over the last few weeks, we've been hearing stories from the White Lotus Sutra. The White Lotus Sutra is primarily, almost entirely, sort of non-conceptual. The teachings in the White Lotus Sutra aren't conceptual teachings. There's not real, sort of, no real lists and concepts. The teachings are all told in the form of stories and parables. What they're trying to do is get beneath that rational conceptual mind and point to perhaps a deeper truth than normally is accessible to reason alone. And today I want to just carry on sort of exploring an episode from the sutra. It's an episode where the sutra becomes truly cosmic. In a way, this is where it becomes the drama of cosmic enlightenment. Okay, so what I want to do is I'm just going to talk a little bit about the episode. I'll tell you the story. So I want you to see if you can sort of get into story mode. In a way, suspend just for the next wee while your kind of critical faculty. Pretend, imagine that you're young, like a child again, listening to a story unfold, and it's a story of the whole that involves the whole universe, in fact many universes as its stage. It's sort of like a transcendental science fiction, a Buddhist transcendental science fiction that sort of unfolds. And see if you can just be open to some of the imagery in the story, without let it sort of just bypass critical judgment, at least for now, and then see what happens. So it begins, of course, the sutra begins on Vulture's Peak, which is this outcrop of rock in northeastern India, in a place called Rajgir. And the land is very flat around Rajgir, apart from this very tall outcrop of rock. Not quite a mountain, but not just a little hill either. It's this very impressive, dramatic place, particularly from the top, because you can see for miles. And of course, it's still there. But mythically, Rajgir isn't just an outcrop of rock in northeastern India. It is the summit of conditioned existence. It's the highest point in conditioned existence. It's the highest point of samsara. And the Buddha is teaching on top of Vulture's Peak. And he's teaching to an assembly of thousands of disciples. Humans, but also bodhisattvas who have, practiced the Dharma for aeons and are very, very close to enlightenment. All sorts of mythical beings are in the assembly, listening to the Buddha. And the Buddha is, in the sutra, he is teaching the White Lotus Sutra. So it begins by him being in meditation, and from his forehead, between his eyes, a great beam of light goes out, a ray of light, and lights up the whole sky. It lights up the entire universe so that those in the assembly can see all these other worlds. And one of the disciples asks, "What's happening? Why has this happened?" And the response is that the Buddha is about to teach the White Lotus Sutra. And the sutra keeps referring to itself. In the sutra you hear much about how meritorious it is to hear the White Lotus Sutra, how important it is to protect and preserve the teachings of the White Lotus Sutra. So very, very kind of mysterious thing, because you can start asking, well, what is the White Lotus Sutra? Because it keeps talking about itself in the sutra. And then all these stories unfold. So after a number of these stories, suddenly something very dramatic, even by the standards of the White Lotus Sutra, happens. So out of the earth suddenly appears an enormous stupa. And a stupa, well, you'll see some on the shrine. They're this sort of object that normally contain the relics of somebody who's died. But this stupa is not just an ordinary stupa, it's enormous, and it's made of the most precious substances in the world. So it's made of gold and lapis lazuli, and well, it's said to be the seven precious, most precious substances, diamond, and it's decorated with banners and jewels, and it's emitting fragrances and sounds. There's music. This enormous thing has suddenly ascended from somewhere in the earth and is now sort of just towering over this assembly, including towering over the Buddha, like some sort of, UFO that's somehow come up from the earth. Huge thing. So people are suddenly taken aback, and of course they ask the Buddha, what's going on? Why? And what is this? And the Buddha replies that the stupa contains the body of another Buddha. And this Buddha was a Buddha who lived many aeons ago in the past and had made a vow that he would appear whenever the White Lotus Sutra was preached. And so, and his name translates as abundant treasures, abundant treasures. The sutra is full of, Supadamati was saying, this symbolism of abundance. Everything is overflowing. It's like there's just, the Dharma is just sort of pouring forth from the Buddha, but also from the whole cosmos. Everything is just overflowing. And now we've got this stupa with a Buddha inside, an ancient Buddha inside, or the remains of an ancient Buddha inside, called Abundant Treasures. And they all want to see, all the disciples, all the bodhisattvas want to see Abundant Treasures. So they say to the Buddha, would you open the door? Would you open the door to the stupa to let us see this marvellous being? And the Buddha says, well, yeah, but it's not so straightforward, because you have to, in order to be able to see abundant treasures, some conditions have to be fulfilled first. And those conditions are to do with all the other Buddhas in other world systems, in all the universes, have to be summoned, and they have to appear to this place, and only then will Abundant Treasures reveal himself. So in order to fulfill their desire to see Abundant Treasures, the Buddha, again through a beam of light, summons or invites all these bodhisattvas, actually, from different galaxies, different universes, to come, because they've been summoned to hear the White Lotus Sutra. And they start arriving. But in order to sort of mate this earth and Vulture's Peak sort of more beautiful for the arrival of all of these cosmic beings, the Buddha transforms this world, because it's somehow not fitting enough. Our world is said to be a rather impure world, full of both joy but also suffering, the potential for enlightenment but also the potential for a lot of hardship and pain. And the Buddha just kind of tidies it up. He not only tidies it up, he makes it incredibly beautiful. So all the trees are now filled with jewels. They're jewels of light. They're jewel trees. The ground is no longer just earth. It's lapis lazuli. There's cords of gold and nets sort of over the ground. The flowers are made of light and raining down on the earth. And of course he marvels up miraculously some thrones, some enormous thrones for these bodhisattvas who are arriving. And they're so enormous, these thrones, that they seem to take up all of space. So suddenly the Buddha has to create more space. And what he does is he looks at the surrounding worlds around Earth and clears them to make more space, makes them more beautiful. So now you're no longer even just on Vulture's Peak or on Earth. The assembly around the Buddha extends to other worlds around this world, all listening to the White Lotus Sutra from, you know, different universes. And when that assembly is now sort of gathered, the Buddha rises up. He just sort of floats into the air to the door, the sort of portal of the stupa. And he opens the door into, as it were, another dimension entirely. And inside the stupa, there is this Buddha. And what's more, not only has his body not decayed, he's alive. He's alive and sitting in this stupa. And he invites our Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, to come and join him, next to him. So our Buddha takes his place next to him. All the beings are sort of a bit sort of perplexed and marvel. They're sort of blown away by this marvel. They all want to see what's happening, and of course it's sort of happening above them. So the Buddha just causes them to all rise into the air. So now they're all at the level where they can peer in and see Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, sitting next to abundant treasures. And then, as if that's not enough, more beings appear, more bodhisattvas appear, and they seem to appear from under the earth. So, you know, you've got all these beings from different cosmos, different aspects of different universe, but now they're coming from under the earth, hordes of them. I mean, just myriads and myriads of bodhisattvas, all of them highly accomplished, spiritually advanced, archetypal beings emerging from the earth, rising up to be part of this assembly. And they all promise to protect the teaching of the White Lotus Sutra. And they each sort of appear before the Buddhas, Abundant Treasures and Shakyamuni Buddha, and say, yes, I will protect and honour the White Lotus Sutra. And there's so many of them, and it takes so long, it takes several aeons for each of them to say, I will protect the White Lotus Sutra and introduce themselves. But of course, the Buddha magically and marvellously makes it seem as if only an afternoon has passed. So nobody gets bored. And all of these beings are now saying, yes, they'll protect the White Lotus Sutra. And then the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, that is, who's sitting, you know, beside abundant treasures, says that all of these, you know, these beings that have just risen from the earth, the bodhisattvas that have just risen, they are all his disciples, that he has taught all of them over aeons. And so people in the assembly are a little shocked by this, because they say, look, you have only been teaching for 40 years, and I don't know why this suddenly worries them when nothing else so far has particularly, they haven't seemed to bat an eyelid at different universes appearing and things. But anyway, suddenly they're concerned. How can this be true, that the Buddha has only been teaching for 40 years, and yet there are these countless bodhisattvas who are much older than that, who are his disciples? How is that possible? And the Buddha says, well, it's possible because actually I'm not just enlightened now. I've appeared in this form as Shakyamuni, but actually I've appeared in countless other forms as countless other Buddhas in the past. I have been teaching, I have been enlightened, and I've been teaching for aeons. I was the Buddha Dipankara. I was the Buddha before him, and the Buddha before him, and the Buddha before him. I have always been teaching the White Lotus Sutra. It's an eternal teaching. And everybody is just completely blown away. Suddenly their notion of who the Buddha is completely expanded into something inconceivable. And as he says this, of course, the universe trembles, other universes tremble, flowers rain down, and there's much rejoicing and celebration. And this, in a way, is the central teaching of the White Lotus Sutra. This is it. This is what is sort of really revered as, one of the central teachings of the White Lotus Sutra, that the Buddha, Shakyamuni, was eternally enlightened, that he wasn't just limited to this historical time and place. So suddenly you've got this cosmic vision that is using the language of imagery, and it's trying to, well, maybe I won't say what it's trying to do just yet. Let's just see if we can stay with some of these images. So we've got countless beings, we've got countless worlds, even other universes. We've got beings being summoned to hear the White Lotus Sutra. We've got this enormous stupa emerging. We've got this Buddha who is called Abundant Treasures, who's still alive after aeons. And then it's revealed that Shakyamuni, too, is an eternal Buddha. So that's the story, or that's the part of the story that I'm going to tell. Just be interesting to see if you have any responses to that, sort of positive or negative. Just let's stay for a few minutes with those sort of initial responses. Never mind what it means. We'll look at what it means or what it might mean in a little bit. But let's just see if there are any responses at all to some of the imagery. Yeah.
So is he saying that he's always been around forevermore?
Yes, he's saying that he was eternal. And again, we'll explore the meanings of that. But let's look at seeing if just what your response was to some of the images in the story or whatever. And then yes, I will come back to that as to what does he mean by saying that he's the eternal Buddha and that he's been around for ever. Yeah, so
for me, my initial response is that it's too big.
Yeah.
To be true.
Yeah.
I can't decipher any kind of meaning.
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually, my initial response was that it reminded me of my mom was Hindu.
Yeah.
And I grew up with a bit of Hinduism in my childhood, and yeah, it reminds me of some of the kind of really colourful, bright, enormous stories from Hinduism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Difficult for me to even begin to grasp.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I found that very off-putting.
Yeah.
Kind of just gave me a bit of a flavour of that.
Yeah. And of course you're onto something there, because it comes from the same cultural terrain as Hinduism. So in a way, the Indian mind from ancient times is using whatever is available in its language to try and point to something that's beyond concepts. But it will use, you're right, it will use a particular sort of form of story. So yes, so hold that sense of being put off It's not unusual to, I think, be put off by Mahayana sutras, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to be put off by these images. But what I'm hoping to do is show how, well, in a way, they can be relevant, or perhaps, if not immediately relevant, certainly more. There's more to it than might meet the eye, first of all. Yeah.
My sort of initial reactions were about that it might be something to do with just the nature of time. How we perceive time.
I think. Go on, no, say more, sorry.
Well, how we perceive time is measured or finite or infinite.
Yeah.
In reality or in dreams.
Yes.
How time kind of, the experience of time sort of changes.
Yes. 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 Yes.
That was my initial.
Yes.
It's a bit scientific.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's a very perceptive observation that Sangharakshita also makes, that somewhere one of the things that's going on here is something to do with the nature of time and our perception of time. Normally, we have, if we think about time at all, we do tend to think of it in just a linear kind of way. But actually, you're right that our actual experience of passing time changes. If any of you, a lot of you have been on retreat, you'll know that on retreat, your experience of time changes. It can feel like a day passes quite quickly and yet is much longer than a normal day because so much more happens. So much more is experienced than you normally would in 24 hours or even. So it can feel like, oh, you've been on retreat forever after just a day, and yet the days pass quite quickly. There's something to do with the nature of our experience when consciousness starts to become more expansive. Our experience of time changes. Or if you haven't been on retreat, you know when you're in, you're bored and you're clock watching and time just seems slow down. It just doesn't, doesn't pass. Or if conversely, if you're having a really good time and you're absorbed in something very, very enjoyable, time can both go very quickly but also seem to have stopped. Your sense of time can just seem to stop when you're really absorbed. And yet, you think, oh, a few hours has just gone. How did that happen? Yeah, so that's from an experiential perspective, that time seems to bend or behave differently, slow down or speed up, depending on our state of mind. But you might say, I don't know if you would say this, but you might say, oh yes, but that's just sort of something to do with psychology or experience. But really, time is always going at the same rate and is completely reliable and predictable. Really, time is just a scientific kind of fact. Does anybody think that? Yes, as if.
Well, I kind of think that insofar as I think the whole concept of measuring time is constructed by humans, therefore our perception of it could change, but the measurement that we've set up, may as well have an objective standard to it, but I think the whole thing is just understood through the prism of the way that we process the reality around us, and it's just completely like man-made.
So you've sort of said two things there, haven't you? That on the one hand, you're saying that it's sort of a human concept that we've developed, but also you're saying that there's something. Are you saying that there's something beyond that going on that is called time? I'm not quite sure what you're saying.
I guess I think that it is just the same way that as human beings experiencing the world, we tend to break things up into subject and object. I kind of think it's like that, you know, because of our senses and the way we process, we try and make sense of the world around us. We also have this sense of linear time passing, but I see no reason why that is kind of objectively true.
Yeah. No, I think that goes to the heart of this. I think what Buddhism is pointing to, and the White Lotus Sutra in its own way is pointing to, is something very much like that. That time is... time arises out of consciousness. Time is a phenomenon, is a function of consciousness. We have consciousness has to have time in order to have experience. But that doesn't mean that what we call time is really some sort of objective reality. It's a construct of consciousness. It's a construct of this human consciousness that, as you say, splits experience up into a subject in here and an object out there. And just as it splits up experience into subject and object, it also creates this construct of time in which experience sort of unfolds. So that to me is really counterintuitive. Although I can say some words like that, it's so counterintuitive as to almost be incomprehensible. But then if you look at scientific notions of time, physics notions of time, well, since Einstein's relativity in the early part of the 20th century, physicists have stopped believing in a completely objective thing called time. One of the consequences of relativity, of special relativity, is that time is dependent on the observer. So, for example, relativity shows, and it's not just relativity, they've done experiments to show this, that if the observer, me, is moving very fast, for me, time slows down. Compared to you, who would be sitting still. So on a high-speed train, time slows down. It's just so small a difference. It's such a small difference, such a imperceptibly tiny fraction of an interval on a normal high-speed train that, for all intents and purposes, you can't even measure it. But as the high-speed train, if it got faster and faster and was travelling at appreciably close to the speed of light, time would really slow down in a measurable way. In a measurable way. This is physics. This is the best theory of time that we have. It's not objective. Or, for example, take another truth that you're probably aware of, is that we think of something happening as now. We think of now as this instant. So, for example, in this instant, you are hearing some words that I'm speaking and they're entering your ears and your mind. And that's happening for you now. But now is a relative concept. Now is a relative concept. So, for example, when the sun rises, the sun is millions of miles away, isn't it? It's 93 million miles away. The light from the sun takes 8 minutes to reach this earth. So when you see the sun, it's actually as it was 8 minutes ago. We're not looking at the sun now. We're looking at the sun, when you see the sun, as it was 8 minutes ago. And the sun is only 93 million miles away. You've got stars and galaxies that are billions and billions of miles away. So when you look up into the night sky and see a star, you're seeing it as it was years ago, like billions of years ago in some cases. Yeah. So your sense of now, that star does a little twinkle. You say, oh yes, I've just seen it twinkle. That twinkle happened billions of years ago. And it's just happened to you now. Yeah? Do you see, now is relative to the observer. Not only is the rate of time changeable, but what happens now is relative. So Einstein at one point, I mean, his model of time was that this whole notion of flow is an illusion. His, and I don't know if this is true or not, but one model of time that is taken really seriously is that everything is always present. The past, the future, and what we call now somehow is always present. And it's not that time is flowing, it's that consciousness is flowing through it. Isn't that weird? Yeah. Now, I don't know if that's true, and actually neither do physicists. They have other models of time. Oh, and by the way, time is, in a way, in relativity, it's seen as another dimension, just as space is seen in three dimensions. So in relativity, you cannot separate out time from space. Because if you move through space very quickly, time changes. And actually, when you move very quickly, space changes as well. Things get shorter. If you're moving really fast, you shrink. So that's really weird, isn't it? Time slows down and you shrink. So space and time bend depending upon what's happening to you, what's happening to the observer. Never mind what I'm going on about in detail. All I'm trying to say is that our common sense notion of time, and for that matter our common sense notion of space, is wrong. Yeah? And we know that from the best scientific theories we have. So if you're going to be really rational, then let's be really rational using the best scientific theories we have. And they say something really weird is going on to both space and time, that it's not what we think it is. And then you've got, I mean, other models of physics that say three dimensions is just the start of space, that there's probably, well, string theory says 12 dimensions or whatever. So suddenly you're in this sort of science fiction world. You're more in sort of Doctor Who land than you are in, you know, Sainsbury's and Tesco land, when you start to look at modern physics. This sutra, I'm not saying it's saying the same thing, but in its own way, I think what it's trying to do is expand our minds beyond our common sense notions of space and time. It didn't have math, you know, the ancient Indians didn't have modern physics or mathematics to talk about this, but they could use stories like infinite number of universes, countless beings, filling limited space. So somehow these countless beings are able to, you know, fill limited space. Then they were able to use images like eternal, and infinite in relation to time. That a whole eons had passed and yet it seemed like an afternoon. The Buddha appeared to have just been teaching for 40 years, but he was eternally teaching. That the White Lotus Sutra can be heard all the time if you open up your mind to it. The Buddha is always teaching the White Lotus Sutra on Vulture's Peak. It used images like this, stories like this, to try and say, look, something else is going on. And what that seems to depend on is the state of our mind. These beings being risen up, it's an obvious metaphor for their mind being elevated. Only then could they see abundant treasures. Yeah? If you change your mind, you start to perceive things differently. And the sutra is trying to point to deeper truths that are experientially possible, but not in the literal sense that you might take from a story. Yeah? So space and time are definitely being played with in this sutra. And that's not just childish fairy tale. That's pointing to something really profound. Any other responses? We're going to run out of time in a minute. Yes.
It's interesting we ended up there, because when you first said, just imagine this image as I explain it.
Yeah.
I can sort of do that quite all right. I can imagine these things as you're saying them. But then I get this sense that I can't imagine this. Do you know what I mean?
But it's too much.
You get to a point where I sort of think, I can't imagine this. You
know, yeah.
Just like, I get these images of what you're saying, and then after a while, I just think, well, how do I fit all these beings in this space? Or how do I flatten the whole world and make it all covered in jewels?
Yeah.
And I get a quick image of it, but I go a bit sort of like, well, I can't really imagine that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So maybe that's not the point.
Yes. No, it is. It's it's an interesting observation, because what you're, I think, saying is that you can get sort of glimpses. It's almost like we get glimpses from the corner of our eye that, oh yeah, I can sort of see that. And then if you look too directly, it all sort of goes wrong. There's sometimes something speaks to us, it sort of sinks in below the rational mind. But if you turn towards it too directly, you kind of think, oh no, that's just rubbish or something. But actually, well, what's... So for example, lapis lazuli and jewel trees, I mean, they may not do it for us, but to the ancient Indian mind, what they were trying to communicate was abundance and beauty and... a sense that actually everything is perfect, that there's nothing imperfect around. And again, I think that that's saying that our perception and our experience is dependent upon our state of mind. The Buddha could, by his influence, his spiritual influence, elevate everybody's state of mind and elevate their perception. And again, if you go on retreat and you meditate, you can come out of a meditation and the world can look radiant. And it may not look like lapis lazuli. On the other hand, I don't know, I was talking to somebody on a retreat a few years ago, and he came in and he needed to talk to me. He was quite stirred and even almost distressed. And he'd had a very strong experience in the meditation. Sort of all sorts of dharmic teachings had started to make sense. And then he said he looked at the path as he came out of the shrine room, and it was as if it was made of jewels. He said everything seemed to be shining as if it were made of jewels. There's an as if being pointed to, which is potentially available to us. In meditation, sometimes you can have visions I'm not very visionary in my own meditation, but nevertheless, I've had glimpses of, well, it's not been trees of jewels, but it's been definitely flowers of jewels, flowers made of light that seem jewel-like, sparkling, opening, moving. And of course, they're images in my own imagination. I'm not saying that they're out there, but they seem to have more than just sort of fanciful significance. They seem to point to a state of mind that's also opening. So you enter into an imaginative realm that's sort of internal. Yeah? And it might unfold for you in different ways. It won't necessarily look like that. But it will and can open up. And if you open it up, if that consciousness opens up, space and time and your conceptions of that, experience of that changes. And also the world looks more beautiful and radiant. Not only more beautiful, there's an experience that's possible, which again doesn't make sense, but it's a heightened spiritual experience where everything is perfect. It's as if everything is just as it should be and always has been. And then when you think rationally, you think, no, it isn't. There's suffering all over the world. There's people dying. There's people being you know, tortured. And there's starvation and injustice and yeah, pain of all sorts. It's not perfect. Yeah, on one level, it really isn't. We live in a suffering world. And part of the Buddha's teaching is how do you help alleviate that suffering, transform that suffering. And then there is a spiritual experience that is as valid, if not, you know, it doesn't cancel out the other truth, where everything is always perfect and always has been. And that is something also true. And the two don't cancel each other out. And that starts to point to different levels of reality. One of the things that Bhante talks about, not so much in this book, but in another book, where he's talking about the Vimalakirti Nidesha, he's talking about different ways of seeing reality. And one is a historical way, and one is a mythic way. There is a historical reality. And in that historical reality, Shakyamuni Buddha did live as a human being who became an enlightened human being roughly 2,500 years ago in northern India. Yes, he probably did go to Vulture's Peak and preach there, but Vulture's Peak is a high outcrop of rock. Then there's a mythic way of looking at those same events. And in the mythic dimension, enlightenment is an eternal principle that just seemed to manifest as Shakyamuni Buddha 2,500 years ago. Vulture's Peak is a mythical pinnacle of the whole of samsaric existence. At that pinnacle, the Buddha is always teaching the most profound truths, because those profound truths are eternal. They're beyond space and time. And in this sutra, those profound truths are termed the White Lotus Sutra. The most profound truth is always being preached by the entire enlightened mind. And it's always available for us to hear and to be raised up to. So that is also a truth. That's also a truth. It has to be framed in terms of images and myth. But by myth, we don't mean just so stories. We mean something like poetry can point to truths that prose can't. It's that myth is pointing to. And we exist on both levels. Obviously, we've got bodies and minds that exist at that historical, so-called sort of historical literal level, yeah? And at that level, we go about our lives and we interact. And that's necessary but we also exist in some way at that mythic level. There is an aspect of consciousness which isn't limited to this historical. And that aspect of consciousness coexists all the time with the historical and is accessible through Dharma practice. And when you start to experience that aspect, that myth, that mythical aspect of consciousness, it doesn't cancel out the historical, but it somehow contextualizes it in a much bigger perspective. In a much bigger perspective. And this sutra is trying to say that the historical is contained in a mythic perspective, and that mythic perspective is somehow truer. And in this language of this sutra, it can just say, it can point to, well, it just uses words like countless worlds and infinite space and time contracting and eternity being manifest now. But something is being pointed to that's very, very real. Yeah, very, very real. And if you want to experience something of that, well, go on a retreat and really go deeper in meditation. So sometimes people say to me, yeah, all very well, but my meditation isn't like that. Or I can't experience that. And actually you can, but you do have to make some effort. Levels of consciousness are available, higher levels of consciousness are available to all of us, but it does take some effort. Firstly, it takes effort not just in meditation, but outside of meditation. We have to be working on our minds outside of meditation. If we're filling our minds with, self-centered thoughts all the time, and if we're locked in our own identity of this body and the historical, if we don't allow ourselves to occupy higher states of, well, even higher sort of thoughts and aspirations, then our meditation isn't going to really take flight. Similarly, in meditation, meditating for half an hour a day, well, it really is worth doing, but to really experience the power of the mind in this expansive way, you've got to go deeper. And normally it's on retreat that you have that opportunity. So it is possible to experience something of the principles, at least, even if they're not behind the sutra, even if you don't experience them in the way that is being described in this cultural context of ancient India. Something else is going on, and it is possible to experience that. And earlier on, while I was talking about Peter's death and saying that metta is somehow, well, it transcends life. And from a Buddhist perspective, we really don't know what life is, because we really don't know what death is. And both life and death are happening in a much, much bigger context. Much, much bigger context. And we can start to have intimations of that context at times through practice. And one of the intimations of that context is when we feel in touch with metta. When we feel connected through metta, it's an intimation of a deeper truth in reality. There's something much, much deeper going on that connects us in a way that we can't see. If we could see it, we would always be in touch with metta. Metta would be the natural response. But when we are in touch with metta, it's as if we've got a hint of that response. So trust that. Trust metta. It is a way to a deeper realization. Yeah.